Episode 7. Someone told me that in the first 90 days on the job, you shouldn't make any major changes. Well, here's what I think about that. So, first off, it really does depend. I can say I've had a handful of different jobs where in the beginning portions of that job, my boss comes to me and says, "This situation is totally jacked up. Here are your marching orders. You gotta fix X, Y, and Z and fix it soon." So in those types of cases, especially when you're brought in as a fixer, you should absolutely start looking to make changes right off the bat. I'm gonna caveat that in a little bit. But now, here's the problem. When you come in and you tell everybody, "I'm here to fix all of you because you're so jacked up," how do you think that makes them feel? Now, I will also tell you that there's a lot of circumstances where everything is jacked up, but the problem actually was leadership, environmental, or a combination thereof. And honestly, as I've gotten older, I realize that really environmental factors are normally solved by good leadership, and it really just boils down to the person who came before you was probably pretty terrible. Or your boss is pretty terrible. One way or the other, a good leader is able to overcome all of those. And hopefully, if you're listening to this, you're a good leader, or at least aspiring to be so, as I am also aspiring to be so, and just thinking about it with you. Okay, so here's the thing. You can't tell the people that you're coming in to lead that they're all messed up and you're going to make changes and you're the solution that they've been looking for, or you're going to turn everything around, right? You want to come in with humility. You want to be that level 5 leadership we've talked about before. Come in with humility and ask questions. I think asking questions is probably one of the best things that you can do in the first 90 days, or actually as just as an important skill in general. So here's something I want you to think about, and that is, what is then the impact of morale when you start making these changes? I have developed over time a theory, maybe model is a better term, and it's called the morale curve. Okay, and in the morale curve, I want you to imagine for a little bit in the beginning that your morale and your standards are at equilibrium. Okay, say people are unhappy, and you know, so they have a low morale, and the standards are pretty low. Now, what happens is, as you raise the standards, people's morale will dip because now you're expecting more of them, and they say, "Well, you know, it already sucks around here, and now you're coming in here and you're making me do all of these things." Okay, so imagine you've got a horizontal line for morale, right? A horizontal line for standards, and then boom, immediately morale jumps up, stair steps up to a higher level, or the standards stair step up to a higher level, and your morale immediately tanks. Okay, standards, as long as they don't change, they just stay as a kind of a horizontal line there, and your morale goes down. Now, after a certain amount of period of time passes, what will happen is people kind of get used to it. You know, this is the new normal, and assuming that you don't make any more changes to the standards, they'll kind of reach an equilibrium there. Okay? And then some time passes after that, and then they realize, hey, you know, these standards that just went up, they've actually resulted in us winning more. We are now more successful. The results are better. They get more meaning out of their jobs. And so then what happens? Morale starts to go up. And then eventually, they reach a new steady state, a new equilibrium, and then it levels out. So you kind of imagine, what happens is, if you were to kind of draw this on a dual axis, right, where your x-axis is time and your y-axis is morale or standards, right? So you have a horizontal line for standards, and then a immediate jump up, and then another horizontal line for your standards. So it looks like a stair step. and then your morale looks like a kind of a sideways S, if you will. It reaches that asymptote at the top, okay? Now that's kind of important, right? Because if in the initial stages, there's a couple things that you have to be very careful about when you're making changes. If in the initial stages people are close to their breaking point, then what happens is if you raise the standards too high, if they drop, if their morale drops and drops below that breaking point, really bad stuff starts to happen. You start dealing with people quitting. In the military, you start seeing people having suicidal ideations, right? You can't want to push anybody past their breaking point. Okay? So you need to be able to be very deliberate and calculating about how high of your standards you need to go in order to not push people past their breaking point. And one of the other things to look at is if when morale is at the bottom and you raise the standard again, the morale will immediately start to drop again. Okay, so it's very dangerous to raise the standards while people are still dealing with the previous time you raised the standards. It's very, very important for people to start to see the results of the changes that you made before you start changing things again. People call that moving the goalpost, right? Where every time they do something and they think they're doing it well, then you add more stuff on and they never get a chance to really see the fruits of their labors. Now, if I were to say do this 5 times, right, where every time I create a change, morale drops, they do it for a little bit, starting to kind of get used to the new normal, and boom, morale drops again, and then boom, morale drops again, and I do that 5 times, morale is going to be through the floor. People are not going to like you, they're not going to want to work for you. But now if I were to take all 5 of those changes, lump them all together, implement them all at once, now what's going to end up happening is I'm actually having a less steep drop before that morale steadies out and then comes back up again. So, but now how do I know what those 5 things are? Well, it takes some time to observe, right? So it's important to take some time when you first show up in a place to observe, ask some questions, and learn. So one of the first things you want to go do is you want to identify what is that breaking point. Because the more stuff you dump on people, the more that morale is going to drop. So if you make 1 change, morale is going to drop a little bit. You make 10 changes, the morale is going to drop a lot. Now, those 10 changes with that drop in morale is going to be less severe than 10 incremental changes in a row. Right? So it's better to group them together if you can, because overall that penalty is not as bad. But if people are already close to their breaking point, trying to make all that change happen all at once is probably going to make them break. So you have to be very careful about how close, and cognizant about how close people are to the breaking point. And this can either be as a group or each individual. There's a range of morale typically within each organization. You can kind of get a good feel about the average morale, right? But you're not going to know about each individual. So if it's spanning, what you're really worried about is that weakest link or the person who's dealing with the most stress already. They're going to be the ones who are breaking, even though you may have some people in the group that are a little bit more resilient. Okay, so but now how do I know? If, let's say I have to make 10 changes, and let's say I can only make 3 changes, I've assessed my environment, and I know that I can only make 3 changes without pushing people to their breaking point, and then I'm going to let that stabilize, and then I'm going to make the remaining 7 changes, right? Because once it stabilizes, then I know that the morale is actually going to be happier, that's going to move me up higher past that breaking point. Right, that gives me a little bit more margin to work with. I can now implement that second grouping of 7 changes, right? So we can go do that. How do I know which of those 3 that I need to do? Well, a lot of that's going to be, do you know what your mission is? Do you know what your objectives and your tasking are? Now, if your boss gives you marching orders and gives you a set of priorities, then that's what you should really address. First and foremost is trying to prioritize those things that they asked you to do. And typically, that's kind of one of those stop the bleeding type of situations, right? Where you come across somebody who's bleeding profusely, right? Before you do anything else, you want to start the breathing, stop the bleeding, right? So you want to take care of the immediate circumstance first before you start moving on to other things. Kind of stabilize the situation, stabilize, you know, your organization that's in free fall, okay? Stabilize with those small handful of changes. And once you're kind of out of the crisis zone, you've got a little bit more to, room to breathe. So that's what I would recommend first and foremost. One of the other things is that, hey, if you don't have any guidance from your boss, typically you're going to have one or two people who are going to be very vocal in the beginning. And one of the things that I find is the ones who are the most pissed off in that organization are usually going to be the ones who have the most ideas or the most desire to see positive change. So the initial gut reaction is when you see somebody who's like cursing and swearing and they're really grumpy and angry, you say, I don't want to deal with that person. Well, the thing is obviously they're emotional about being at work. And the only reason why people are emotional is because they care. And if they didn't care, it wouldn't affect them. So you want to find the people that care the most and ask them what they think. And the people who are sitting there quietly, completely indifferent, I'm not going to say that they're lost on you, right? But they're not going to be the ones who are going to be able to channel a lot of that energy. Because if you can get some people who are really, really angry, and you can realize that there's a way that they can channel that energy into something positive, you're going to have a very strong ally in your corner and making the changes. And more importantly, oftentimes they'll have a whole bunch of recommended changes right off the bat that they'd like to implement but have not thus far been able to do. So they can help you prioritize on what things you need to start off with as well. One of the other things that you can do when you're making those changes in the beginning is try to, first and foremost, you want to make sure that all of the changes that you implement are changes where you are raising a standard. What I mean by that is that there is already a standard in place and you are making it higher. And that, when I say that, is it's well understood that that is an objective or a measure that people should be aspiring for, and you're making it a more aggressive standard. That standard needs to be tied to what I would call win criteria. As in, when they meet that standard, they are winning. So if I sell widgets and the standard is how many widgets that I produce, and I want to overall increase my productivity or my profits for my organization, one of those standards is we need to be producing more. Now, I'd say that one probably is not as good of a standard to implement, simply because there's typically, it's almost too broad, right? There's typically a lot more things that go into, hey, you're not producing enough. And it goes back to those environmental things or procedural or bureaucratic limitations or whatever else, right? And so a lot of that is going to be, instead of just cracking the whip over your people's backs and telling them you need to do more, sometimes it's worthwhile to dig a little bit more into it and find out why it is that they're not doing more, and breaking down those barriers in parallel with expecting them to do more. Now, if I'm looking for increasing profitability and producing more enables me to profit more, then producing more would be a good standard, because now I've raised how many I'm expecting them to do. They do more, profit goes up, And then boom, we're winning. We're winning more than we were before. Morale goes up and everyone's like, hey, I'm on top of my game. So be very careful that whatever it is that you're asking for people to do is tied to those win conditions, is tied to, hey, when I did that thing that you asked me to do, now I'm meeting the measures by which I am being judged by my bosses, by the organization. And in the commercial sector, you're talking about profit, typically, right? On the military side, it becomes a little bit more difficult because you have to set those win conditions for them. We're not driven by profit or driven by typically other things. And so you have to be able to say, either being able to operate in accordance with a certain procedure, how many reports you put out, or how many operations you did, and then sometimes you have to create new measures of success. One of those ways that I've been able to do that successfully is you create a level of knowledge exam, okay? And what that will do is it now creates an assessment mechanism. And then that assessment mechanism is the new standard. And so if you give somebody an assessment, a level of knowledge assessment, again, we're raising the standard. What are they going to do? They're going to be very unhappy in the beginning. Oh, my morale is already terrible. People are already beating up on me. And now you're giving me this test. What the F, right? But what's going to happen is you give them a test. You identify knowledge deficiencies across your whole organization. You find out where they're weak. You train to those weaknesses. You reassess them. Hey, guys, remember when we did that assessment and we found all those deficiencies and we trained on it? Well, now when we did the assessment, you guys have now exceeded those standards by 50%, right? You have exceeded my expectations. You have now doubled your scores, yada, yada. Boom, look at what a great job you guys are doing. And now they're happy because you came in there, you gave them extra work, they hated you for it. Then you gave them more work about making them do training and education and learning. But now on the back end, they have something to show for it. Now they're winning, whereas previously they were just grumpy because people were complaining that they didn't know enough or couldn't do enough, right? So you had to create a new standard in order to allow people to win. Now, all of these things really take time. And I think really what it boils down to is you have to have a strategy that you've developed in order to implement all these things at once. Now, if you implement them at once, one of the other cool things is I can, at the onset, tell the team, here is the standard that I am looking for. If we do these following things, here is the result you're going to get. And what that enables you to do is by painting the picture of what that end state looks like in their minds, you're able to start to receive those gains before the gains have even happened. And we're talking about morale here, right? Hey, I am willing to work extra hard right now because I know in the end I will be winning. And it's the same thing on like a sports team, right? People are going to be willing to work extra hard in practice because they know that the harder they work in practice, the more likely it is that they will win games. So it can backfire because if they work really hard and then they don't win games, now you have just violated their trust. You're not getting the results that they were looking for. And that's why it's so important that when you choose standards to raise, that they are tied to win conditions. And when win conditions don't exist, you have to put them in place. You have to create new win conditions, new aim points. What are people aiming for? What are they trying to achieve? And then when they achieve it, you can provide accolades and recognition. Hey, if you don't have those end states, don't just start telling people to do more things and do more and more and more, because then at the end of the day, they're going to work very, very hard. And when is enough enough? If I say, I want you to produce more widgets, okay, well, I produced more widgets and you're still not happy. You just want more. So what does it even matter, right? But if the goal is we're going to raise 10% of widgets, or we're going to do whatever else, and we've got a big, hairy, audacious goal, we've got something that we're aiming for, or more than the other guys, it helps to gamify, right? It helps to allow people to want to work extra hard because they know at the end there's some meaning there. So really what it boils down to is, in the initial stages, the most important thing that you can do as a leader is to get to know your people, get to know the organization, get to know what are people's capabilities, what are their strengths and their weaknesses, what is the organization's mission, what are its weaknesses. Do people have a clear understanding about what that organization is working for? Do they have an understanding about what their win conditions are? How do I identify objectively who the best is? Is it some subjective process? A lot of companies have these performer of the quarter programs. But the performer of the quarter programs are so vague and arbitrary that nobody really understands why they're selected or not. And so it's not something that someone really, that they even can aspire to. They can't work to be the best because there's no rules to the game that they can play by. Now, I will tell you, it's very dangerous to gamify everything and to kind of pit people against each other. Now, there's two kinds of ways that people get motivated. You have an extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. Now, an extrinsic motivation is going to be when I am motivated by things that are happening outside of my brain, outside of me and my understanding of the world, right? Extrinsic motivated people are motivated by things like money and fame and recognition. And so if they're not getting those things, they will not want to produce. Intrinsic motivated people are going to be the ones that do it because they find meaning in the work itself. So a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about, right, about win conditions and accolades and all those kinds of things, understand that for many people, that is only going to work if they are extrinsically motivated. Okay? However, that's not necessarily to say that intrinsically motivated people don't appreciate some recognition. You know, I'm doing my job because I want to do a good job, because I'm personally satisfied by completing these challenges and just kicking butt and taking names. But I appreciate when people come up to me and say, hey, you did a really great job that time. Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. It makes me feel good. Okay? So one of the ways you can kind of get around this is, well, first and foremost, understand that within any workplace, you're typically going to have a mix of the two. I'm going to have intrinsically motivated and extrinsically motivated, and it's not necessarily a bad thing to have people who are extrinsically motivated. But understanding that if you have a workplace that's dominated by those extrinsic motivators, you will sometimes cheapen the value for those intrinsically motivated people. So what I mean is this. If somebody gives you a gift and you say, thank you for that gift, here's $10, or here, let me pay for it. They're going to be upset with you, right? Because they gave you the gift, in most cases, because it's from the heart or something that they thought that you would like. And what you did is you responded with cash. Okay, someone makes something for you, and then you say, hey, here's some money to cover it. Right? You've just cheapened that gift. So if somebody is working hard because they find the value of the work, and they're meanwhile, the boss is like, oh, that's great that you put your blood, sweat, and tears into this thing. Here's $10, or here's a $100 reward. You know, that can cheapen it, because that's not why they were doing it. And so those types of people oftentimes will move on and go do other things. So one of the things that you can do is say, now that. As in, now that you have done and exceeded the standards that we had set, I will recognize you. Okay? Now, intrinsic and extrinsically motivated people are all motivated by having a goal to work towards. But they're not necessarily motivated equivalently on how that recognition comes to play. So, what it boils down to is, if I create the rules of the game, and I give people a clear aim point, and I have them all working together and supporting each other and moving out on something, I don't have to say at the very beginning, when you succeed, I will be rewarding the number one person with a $100 gift card. Because then what you're doing is you're cheapening that process, and you're only really reaching out to those extrinsically motivated people. So a lot of the intrinsically motivated people are not even going to play the game, because many of them don't even want the recognition. They actively do not want the recognition. A lot of them are very humble. They don't want to be called out in front of their peer group. You know, maybe they want some accolades, but not necessarily public. Okay, the extrinsically motivated people, they want the trophy. They want the money. They want to be able to brag about how great they were. Okay? So you break this conundrum by not talking about cash value, cash rewards, right? You can clearly say, hey, at the end, once we've done all these initiatives and everything else, we will have achieved that goal, right? You can help to paint the picture of the end state, but do not paint the picture of what that recognition will be, right? Do not tell them, we will give you this reward or this money, or we'll have a party or whatever else, okay? Don't do that. So you can still gain some of those rewards or those morale gains in the beginning, but be very careful about how you paint that end state when you're talking to your team. Now, once you're at the end state, you say, now that we have achieved, I wanted to give you guys some recognition, or I wanted to say thank you, right? You can start doing at that point in time with, I wanted to recognize, now that we have achieved our first quarter goals, I wanted to recognize the top performer. You know, Bob Smith achieved this with this much whatever. And team two was the highest performing team. Round of applause for everybody. Yay, everyone's happy. Okay, boom, there you go. Okay, that's a now that goal. So what that does is it's a subtle shift to get everyone motivated more intrinsically. The extrinsic motivators are now thinking to themselves, huh, if I want to win, I want to get some recognition, I don't know when the next time that people are going to be recognized. I should be working hard like that all the time. And the intrinsic people, pleasantly surprised, take the money, move on, right? You get everybody on board. You start shifting your workplace away from extrinsic motivators to intrinsic. Now, the danger there is that you can't give people the impression that every time you're working towards a goal that they're going to get cash prizes or whatever else, right? So it's a little bit of a balancing act. But again, the important thing is that you want to structure things in such a way that it's a surprise once they reach those goals. So now all of this really boils down to understanding what kind of a culture that you have, what kind of people that you have, what are they motivated by, why are they there? You know, certain industries are typically dominated by very extrinsically motivated people, and other ones are dominated by intrinsically motivated people. You'd say teachers are typically not in it for the money. There's not really much money in teaching, but they do it because they love the job, they love the people, they get value out of seeing those kids learning, right? Intrinsically motivated. That is that type of person that's drawn to that career type. Now, Wall Street bankers, those are extrinsically motivated typically. They're going to be, and these are generalizations, so we're not trying to sling some stereotypes of people, right? But a Wall Street banker, right? They're going to be motivated by how much money do they rake in, right? How much money are they making? That's what that industry is based upon. Those are extrinsic motivators. You know, what kind of bonuses do they get at the end? Okay. So these are those types of things that you want to be looking at. So what do I think? I think in the first time period that you're at a job, however long that is, you need to be spending the bulk of the time getting to know people, getting to know the culture, coming up with a game plan, identifying which standards need to be raised and which ones don't, building up the rules of the game, and allowing people to clearly visualize what winning looks like. If there's a crisis on hand, it is not an option to wait to fix the crisis. It isn't. And there's a variety of ways that you can do to identify what that crisis is, but you have to fix the crisis first. But then once the crisis is done, take your time, come up with a strategy, and then implement it with everybody on board. They're not going to be happy. You know they're not going to be happy, but weather the storm. Stick it out, understanding that once their morale drops, it's going to come back up again once they start winning. And keep in mind that there's ways that you can help to mitigate the amount of pain that people feel and the amount of morale that drops in the short term by helping them to clearly visualize where you're going with that team. So it's absolutely possible. The first 90 days really depends. Depends on the timeline. So what do you think? I'd love to hear what you think. I'd love to continue this conversation, and feel free to email me. My email address is thinkinghardisnewknowledge@gmail.com, and I look forward to hearing from you.